You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
We're here at Pentecost after our Easter season, a time when the church celebrates the pouring out of the Holy Spirit. Today we're going to be focusing particularly on two of the readings, Ezekiel 37, 1-14, and Acts chapter 2, 1-21.
And we're very fortunate to be joined by the Reverend Ian Ferguson, who's the Uniting Church Minister at Brunswick Uniting Church in inner north of Melbourne, a lively community. Welcome to By the Well, Ian. Thanks for coming along.
Thanks, Fran. Great to be here. I'm a regular listener, and it's good to actually see the inner workings of By the Well.
Yeah, welcome.
So you've celebrated a lot of Pentecost as a minister, Ian. I'm just wondering if there's one or two particularly that stand out for you.
Yeah, look, Pentecost for me is always an opportunity to bring colour and movement into the church. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, dynamic story of the coming of the Holy Spirit, so it lends itself to, waving fabrics and burning candles and all the rest of it. But one service that particularly comes to mind is last year's Pentecost, and obviously that comes to mind because it's the most recent, but also because it was it came in the midst of lockdown. Mm-hmm. And so colour and movement in our church wasn't something that was possible, and we were doing pre-recorded services at that stage last year. And to reflect then on what the coming of the Spirit meant in that context, where people couldn't be together, as they are in the story of Acts, of course, that's a key point in that story, that the disciples are all gathered together. Given that we're separated and scattered, how does the Spirit speak into that context? And that's an ongoing situation for people in many parts of the world. And So yes, the unifying power of the Spirit was very strongly present in my mind and in the life of our community at that time.
Yeah, I was reflecting this week as I was preparing for this. I used to fondly remember Pentecost in my first placement, because it was a country placement, and for some reason they had a tradition that Pentecost all the congregations would come together, often outdoors, or it's a winery region. So there was a Pentecost at Brown Brothers Winery where everyone picnicked, but it did have that festive.
So you were drunk with wine.
on that occasion it's a possibility, yes. Whereas, yes, we'll get to Acts 2 in a moment, but I do love Peter's "We can't be drunk, it's the morning." Yeah. Clearly no Australians there, yeah, is all I can say.
No. Right, let's come to the texts, I think. We'll start with Ezekiel. Now, a strange, wonderful book, but strange visions and peculiar happenings.
Yeah, I do love it. I have a soft spot for Ezekiel, I have to say, but it is a long and hard text, and actually there are strands of Jewish tradition where they did not let young men, study this text until they were 33, because you were not mature enough until that magic age to study Ezekiel, because it's mystical, so it required a certain maturity. But it is a text, just to remind people, written by, it tells us we don't know much about Ezekiel except what we have here. He's a priest who was based in Jerusalem. Probably highly educated, very familiar with the temple rituals, and a priest who was removed in 596 when Babylon first took Jerusalem and Judah captive. And we know from history that they and the Babylonians kept great records that they actually removed the elites from the land. Mm. So it's situated, written from Ezekiel's perspective, as one in exile in Babylon, looking back and yearning and reflecting and warning potentially those still in Judea about, you know, that things are not over yet. So the first half of the book is quite, it has visions, and then there's quite a lot of bleak warning stuff. Where in chapter 37, we're in the last part of the book, which starts around 33, which is all about restoration and hope. So we've moved into these more hopeful passages with lots of different images and metaphors for what hope might look like.
And the vision in Ezekiel 37, very evocative.
Yes.
And the subject of many an artwork.
And many a liturgical dance.
And many a liturgical dance.
Mm. Okay. Which, Ian, you'd know about as a former ballet dancer.
Correct.
Yeah.
Are there textual points, Robin, that you think we need to know about particularly?
Well, there's two words that are quite important, which I think any reader can notice, which is bones and then this spirit word. So bones are repeated about 11 times in these verses. And bones in the Bible are a way of referring to like the deepest part of ourselves, so almost like our inner part. So the Psalms talk about my bones wasting away or my bones shaking. And then this spirit, ruach, can mean wind or breath. And Robert Alter in his translation actually makes the comment in the footnotes that he thinks we shouldn't translate it consistently in this passage. There are times when it clearly has more of a sense of wind and clearly has more of a sense of spirit that evokes other passages. So we can think about – I mean, it's one of those tricky words with translation where if we just kept it as ruach – it could capture all of those senses at once, but if we have to pick an English word, we perhaps...
Yeah, I often wonder about that, you know, the fact that we do need to pick a word to translate it with, because in its original context it holds all that meaning.
And,
I struggle often with how to bring that out in passages like this.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, you could hybrid it, you know, like... the wind spirit or I mean, it could get awkward in preaching.
It's like the Torah law point we were making last week too. We want to translate Torah as law all the time, and it has connotations that are unhelpful in English that are not there in the original.
Yeah. One thing I'd say exegetically, and let's unpack the images, and Ian, I want to hear what struck you in this reading, but one of the things that really strikes me with this very dry bones, right, We see this valley. We don't know where it is. Ezekiel's just sort of transported, as he is in many of these visions. But the point is made that these bones, they're everywhere and they're very dry, which is like utterly dead.
Oh, yeah.
Now, again, in Jewish tradition, there's a commandment in the law that you bury your dead. Mm. And along with it, this accompanying sense that burying your dead and having family tombs is a way of staying connected to the dead. And so the ultimate sort of desecration of the dead was to not bury them, to not have a grave or a family tomb. So this is almost like a double death. This is as bad as things can be, that not only is there this kind of almost battlefield image of dead bodies, but that they're disembodied and they're so dry that no one has come to care for them or bury the bones. It's about a bleak as image as you can get.
I was challenged by that, by the fact that, that there's an evocation of a battlefield here. And so not only is it that sort of bleak, abandoned sense of death, but it's violent, that there's violence in it as well.
Yeah, there really is, isn't there? What else did you notice, Ian? What strikes you from this passage?
As a preacher, I'm always looking for things to, engage with, things that might inspire me to then be able to speak out of. And look, that image of the battlefield, I'll start with that. That's something that I might look to avoid, actually. Yes. but you know, it connects with me in a challenging way. How might the implicit violence that leads to this stark place, speak into our time? You talked about this part of Ezekiel containing images of hope, and I think that's the bottom line for me. You know, this is a story of hope out of complete despair, complete abandonment, complete loss, and also it's a story about new life coming from a place of impossibility.
Yes,
life where there cannot be any life. You know, mortal, can these bones live?
The actual answer is really no.
Absolutely, although not we do under get any circumstances,
we do get a kind of more pious answer, you know, Lord, it is you that knows.
Yes,
well done, Ezekiel. But I think the rest of us would be like, no way.
Exactly.
One point that I noticed, though, in it, so it talks about the restoration of the whole house of Israel.
Yeah.
So definitely all very dead in this scene, but they're not all dead. Mm. So there's something about this is a story of resurrection for Christians in Christian language, I suppose you could say.
Yeah.
But I think an important point. Isn't it that this is resurrection not after death? Even though we've been talking about bones, it's resurrection within life as well. Mm. So that it's resurrection as creation, recreation.
Yes,
that can happen in this life now. Mm. So it's not after death.
No, it's.
Because it's not the whole of Israel isn't dead.
Yeah, it's metaphoric, but as it's written, we don't have to make it metaphoric.
No, it's clearly a metaphor. Yeah. But it's clearly a metaphor for Israel.
Yeah, but for steering away from the notion that resurrection and hope is, or that resurrection, we are only talking about life after death.
Yeah, I think for that reason I actually prefer language of restoration here. Partly because I think Christians can't hear resurrection except from something quite individual to do with life and afterlife. Mm. Whereas this is
I'm not saying that. Yeah, then, yeah, yeah.
But this is very much about the restoration of God's people after utter devastation. So in that sense, it's not individual. So theologically, what comes through to me here is it's hope that God will act. And that God will act communally. Mm. It's the whole community that is reformed, if you like. Mm. And there's no preconditions. It's, you know, this vision is of just that God will act, not that if you do these five things, God might think about it, but actually.
Well, I think there's one thing that is striking and radical about this is that you've named that in Ezekiel up to now it's been Ezekiel being very hard against Israel and, you know, you've done dreadfully and you are condemned and God judges you. But this is even this mandate or edict is reversed in this action.
Mm. Yeah.
That, you know, even the divine law, as I've been telling it to you, is restored, reframed and transformed in this moment.
Another indication that Christianity gets its grace from from the Hebrew scriptures.
Yeah, that's right. This is the gracious gift of God, not anything earned. It's worth pointing out, too, the other thing that struck me towards the end of this passage in verses 13 and 14, we get twice repeated that God does this so that you will know, you shall know that I am the Lord when I open the graves, is Robert Alter's translation. Mm-hmm. I didn't check what the NRSV says there. And again, at the end, you shall know that I, the Lord, have spoken and done it. So it reminds me of what we get all through Exodus is that, you know, I'm the Lord, your God, who brought you out of slavery. You'll know God by what God does. Mm. And in this case, it's not liberation from slavery, but it's liberation from the grave.
Mm. Yeah. And I'm also drawn by the strong images of new creation in this vision. Mm. And we'll see those also in our Pentecost reading in a moment. But yes, that the way that this new life and hope comes in this vision is very much the way that life comes in the creation story, through the breath of God breathed into the dust of the dry bones. So, I think there's places to go for preachers in engaging with the challenges of our relationship with creation right now, for example, and a place where hope can be fragile, and what does it mean then to trust in the ongoing creative power of God, the new creation that we're invited to take hope from in stories like this.
Yeah, and you've just reminded me it's not on our roster to talk about today, but the Romans 8 reading, of course, does bring in that broader perspective of all creation groaning. And if you go to something like the Book of Revelation, again, recreation is all of creation. It's not just human revival. Mm. So that would work well with that theme.
Mm. We're not specifically talking about the Romans 1 in this episode, but I am struck by the intimacy of the relationship of the Spirit with us as well as the broad creation, but also the Spirit intervening with sighs too deep for words because we don't know how to pray. That so there's I think, you know, it's Pentecost and we'll come into Acts reading in a moment, but all the dimensions of the Spirit's relationship with creation and with us come through both all the readings.
Mm. In
the global,
ways.
The universal, yep. and the very local, yeah, and the personal.
That's right, and the communal, which and the communal. Robin yeah. Mentioned later, I think, is strongly there as well, obviously, in this reading.
Yeah.
But yes, the work of the breath of God, the Spirit of God, to not just bring hope, but to bring hope for people together, to bring hope for community, for life on earth.
Mm. Mm.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find the link at our website, fatherwell.com.au.
Now, Acts 2, verses 1 to 21, a dynamic story of joy
yes.
and drama.
Yeah.
Mm. I am struck by the word filled that comes through, the filled by the Holy Spirit. There's something very embodied about that,
mm-hmm.
Something intoxicating about it.
Mm.
Where do you want to start with that one, Robin?
Well, we might start by just pointing out a few words again, and that Pentecost, for so many people sitting in our pews, it's a Christian festival, but a reminder that this was first a Jewish festival. It's the it's Shavuot, or the Festival of Weeks, so it was a harvest festival, and one of the three festivals of the year where Jewish men, males in the family, were expected to go to Jerusalem and offer sacrifices. So this scene only makes sense if we remember that we're at a Jewish festival. It's 50 days after Passover, or 7 weeks, and that's why twice when, and I don't know if the NRSV has actually sort of blurred over this in an attempt to offer inclusive language, but twice the crowd is referred to specifically as men, as Andres or Aner, not with the anthropos. This isn't a human, this is a very, we start with the 12 men who've been chosen and then addressing a crowd of men. And I must say in revisiting this, I was like, oh, where are the women? But they come in at the end, it's okay. But, because that was the tradition, and it is a multicultural crowd in that they're all Jews, but we get that long list, of course, of them coming from all over, so diaspora Jews at this time.
Mm. Robin, just on the 50 days, the festival being, that length of time after Passover, that struck me looking at it this time, partly because we're doing this a week before and I'm thinking about what comes before it.
Yeah.
My head's full of that. But that there's this long wait for the Spirit, which is not there in John's Gospel, of course, but
no.
But in Acts, there's that, the disciples are commanded to wait for the power from on high, and it's a long wait. It's a decent wait.
Yeah, 7 weeks of being in Jerusalem, going okay,
any
day now.
So it just struck me that there's some similar themes coming through there, as in perhaps in Advent, like those sort of patience, waiting, hoping kind of themes there that we wait on God. So that's something that could be picked up.
Yes, and could even link back to Ezekiel in terms of waiting for God's restoration.
Yep. Yeah,
which is not necessarily something seen immediately, but
a multi-generational wait in that case.
Yes.
And of course, our wait as Christians is 2,000 years and counting.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. What else did you both notice in the text? Any other things to point out with the language? Again, we've got wind and spirit, and we've got two different words. So the word for the sort of mighty wind early on is actually a specific word for wind. It's not spirit. And then, of course, we get this pneuma spirit language everywhere. And I was struck this time by both the visual and the verbal. I mean, in that sense, it is a very dramatic scene. Mm. There's sound that accompanies the arrival of God, and then there's
fire which evokes the burning bush. Like there's stuff around how God presents God's self here too.
Evoking it's not gentle, is it? It's a violent wind.
Yeah.
So I'm inclined to think in terms of wildfire and storms and this coming is
and people are not fearful though; they're amazed and astonished.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
But it's interesting they're not fearful when we do. We have had fearful responses, by the disciples recently.
Yeah. Mm. But it's not a quiet, still wind. Mm. But, yeah, you're right. It's not quite fear-evoking. We've got other kinds of amazement and various.
I want to ask a question, and I don't know the answer to it, and it's, but I'm struck too that, you know, in our context in the Western church, mainstream church, which is declining in numbers and so on, how we read something like this. Do we, it's a source of joy, but is it a reminder of, you know, do we compare ourselves to this?
That our mission is not quite so successful or is very unsuccessful.
I'm just wondering if there is a tension there or not. There might, you know.
Well, I think, doesn't the story tell us that it's all about the Spirit, it's not about us, you know? So I think that's a potentially encouraging word to the church in a low place, perhaps in a bit of an Ezekiel dry valley kind of place, that, yes, it's the work is the work of the Spirit, that we're
not to compare ourselves in that sort of crude sense to this.
Or that our discernment is then that back to your waiting in. It's the waiting for the Spirit, and then when the Spirit comes, being prepared to act in whatever direction the Spirit might take us. Which here, I mean, there's a very strong emphasis on witnessing, really. I mean, it manifests as speech in multiple languages, not ecstatic speech, quite different to the way this gets talked about in Pauline texts. So whatever the Spirit does here, there's some gift that they're able to talk about what Jesus did in these multiple languages.
And understand one another.
And actually that's a word thing that I like, that the tongues of fire also evoke the tongues that are spoken. I gather that the Greek word there is has the same double meaning as in English, tongues.
Yes, it does. Yeah, it's this glossa word, so it can literally mean language or a tongue by which you speak, and the author's playing on both.
The languages. Sorry.
No, go.
The languages become a theme then right from the start. It's not just once they get out there that they start speaking in these languages, you know, that the fire, that the Spirit itself comes to them as language. And so it's a lot about how we speak, how the church speaks, you know, and the prophetic language that is given to the disciples through this gift.
Connected to that as an emphasis I would want to make too, that so it's communal. We've talked about that, and it's evidently communal in both the readings quite clearly. But it's not in for us, like it's for the sake of the world. There's an outwardness. The Spirit gifts us remarkably in diverse ways, not for our own sake, certainly not for our individual sake, and not even for the sake of the community.
Not even for the sake of the local congregation.
No, that's
frankly
what I mean. That's what I mean, not for the sake, but for the sake of the world.
Yeah.
So there's this outward posture that is the witnessing one and the testimonying one.
And if we follow the logic of the gifts that's been given, I mean, Ian, you just prompted me to recognise this in the text, that the gift of this of languages is given. I mean, we're sort of almost missing information because they're in a house and the house is filled with this mighty rush. And then somehow they're outside speaking to people and we don't quite know what happened there. But there's a sense that the gift is given and then they go use it. It's not that they're out there having already determined their mission, which I think is what we do in the church. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so there's a sense of, again, that waiting for the gift of God but then being prepared to use it, and that will – your gift will direct the mission, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, I might want to even nuance it. Like, I don't disagree with that, but I would want to maybe nuance it even more. It's like there's this discovery conversion that's gone on for the community and the people, individuals in it, and it's the sharing of that, not the bringing of the gift to somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
It's kind of
in a paternalistic kind of way. It's this relational joy that you then only want to share. And so that you're discovering it again in relationship with other people in a mutuality that's not bringing it over to you who haven't seen it yet.
We might talk about that in terms of language as well, that you know, what is the language that the gospel comes to us in and is then spoken in? And, you know, this story just says, well, every language. Mm. So then as English speakers, what is our relationship to the world? You know, so does God speak English is, you know, what I'm wondering about. And the answer in this story is clearly no. But yep. then on what basis do we learn other languages? You know, does the gospel go out with English behind it, and we just, you know, we learn to speak the languages of the world in order that our vision of the gospel might be imposed, you know, which is the colonial approach that the church has taken over the years, you know, linguistic imperialism was the phrase that I read. Yeah.
Yes, yes, and how to avoid actually continuing to do that in a whole variety of ways.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So trusting that the Spirit speaks between us, I guess, you know, that they're speaking in languages that they don't know. There's something happening between them and the people that they're communicating to that's not just them.
How exciting would it be, though? Sorry, Anton. I suddenly started speaking to you in Japanese. Like
I am very envious. I've always been like, God, if you want to give me some gifts, just being able to speak some other languages would be great.
Without even practicing already.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So there's something about that delightful connection that would lead to, you know.
Yes.
I mean, having spent some time in the countries where English, where I had to speak another language.
Yes.
You can't be yourself initially, you know, when you're not, don't have great facility.
And when you're trying to communicate in another language, it does change. There's some things you just can't say in the way you normally. So there is that mutuality. You are changed by the experience of encountering the other and conversing.
We need to tie it up in a minute or two, but I just wondered whether it might, you know, one. It's not so much a preaching theme, but just a note that the word spirit conveys, or spirituality, spirit, conveys a lot of things popularly, which is kind of good in terms of an entree for conversation. But what we're reading about here in the readings this week particularly is a real articulation or a definition or an introduction to the specifics of the Spirit of God in Christ.
Yes.
And naming those. And we've done that a bit. No, it's a violent. It's a rushing wind. It's an intimate relationship.
There's both a wildness and an intimacy,
and a radicality in creation and out of death and nothingness.
And a transformation, a communication, and bringing people together, and also. In both stories, quite a strong sense of embodiment, you know, obviously literally in the Ezekiel story and communally in the Acts story. So there's this sense that when we're talking about the Spirit, we're not just talking about something floating, you know, out of our experience, but something that connects with and, in fact, embodies, makes us, you know, makes us real, gives us flesh, you know, in the sense of, who we are and how we are to be in the world.
So, it's not otherworldly, ethereal and abstract.
Yeah.
And it's also not some sort of shallow notion of a peace. I don't know. Sometimes I think the word spirit popularly can be this sort of atomized experience of peace, whereas this is everything, as you just said.
And it's breathed in and it's poured out upon flesh, so there is this... You know, that is that embodied sense.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing we haven't quite touched on too is this quotation from Joel. So we've seen that movement out from the 12 to the men to the diverse languages. I mean, this reading and Acts in general just keeps going outwards.
Mm.
And when Peter starts talking about Joel, I mean, that's, again, quoting a universalism and grace that's already there in the Old Testament texts of, you know, the days where the Spirit pours astonishingly, really, a spirit of prophecy around men and women and male servants and female servants and old and young. You know, the normal social limitations around who's acceptable as a prophet are completely undone in the giving of God's Spirit. And so, you know, for the Christian church too, I would say, you know, the expectations of who speaks with the Spirit, who can prophesy in our churches, who can... and maybe this is something the Pentecostals have actually got right and can remind us of, has got nothing to do with your gender or age or a number of other things we would place around it. But it's,
And to finish, I would say continue the conversation about the Spirit beyond Pentecost Sunday, please.
Yes.
Like, if you're starting it properly for a while now, don't stop it, you know. Keep it going.
Yes, it's often the Trinity we don't talk about.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ian Ferguson, for being with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it was so great. Much. Thanks, Ian.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.